Hello and welcome to CICK News. CICK News is your local and regional news coverage provided by me, Pamela Hassan, and Dan Messick for Smithers Community Radio. This news program is funded by the Community Radio Fund of Canada and the Government of Canada, and our aim is to provide local coverage on stories that affect the lives of Northerners like you. When the provincial government signed the $622.6 million Kyson Regional Hospital construction contract in 2021, the Regional Hospital District agreed to pay $110.2 million plus $3.5 million for the regional business plan as the regional taxpayer contribution to Kyson. The Northwest Regional Hospital District slated to borrow a maximum of $110.2 million toward the project. But then a neonatal intensive care unit, or NICU, maternity ward, of four additional beds for expectant mothers was not included in the original plans for the hospital, which costs an additional $14.5 million. The Dr. REM Hospital Foundation took on fundraising for this $14.5 million project, and the Northwest Regional Hospital District agreed to provide up to $10 million for the Tier 3 neonatal unit. Now, this $4.5 million on the maximum amount of the hospital district could borrow has been quietly approved through debt by the hospital board. The Northwest Regional Hospital Board feels confident that the $4.5 million can be raised through fundraising, but the cost of not having the maternity ward when it came time to approve was a greater cost than the additional cost to the taxpayers. Gladys Attrell is the vice chair of the Northwest Regional Hospital District Board, and I sat down with her to discuss this project funding and the effects it will have on taxpayers in the Northwest. So can you tell me just a little bit about the Tier 3 maternity ward at Kyson Regional Hospital? What does this unit mean for expectant mothers in the Northwest?
Having quality service available and actually being able to build that while a new hospital was being built. So kind of taking advantage of one really good situation and making it better. And so it does mean better service for people that are going to need it. And I think in terms of the timeline, the hospital had been approved, then the request for this kind of in parallel to the hospital development. And so it was recognized it was a good idea. Mm-hmm. And so the board accepted it. And then the funding was, you know, some of it to be paid for in taxes and some of it to be paid for in fundraising.
Why wasn't this funding decision made more public?
When you have public funding and you're trying to do public fundraising, mm-hmm. it's nice for people to feel motivated for fundraising. And I think that was the gift that the foundation was offering, as we're going to try to work with the community to raise some money that way as well. Mm-hmm. So now as we're going through budget process, we'll see. But at the same time, being able to get an additional facility well needed, that will be well used, that will last for a very long time, is still worth it. And I think sometimes, you know, if we hold fast to our budget and say we're not going to take advantage of this opportunity, on balance, the public is not well served. Mm-hmm. Because something, you know, building things simultaneously makes sense.
Yeah. Okay, yeah. How will taxpayers in the Northwest be affected by this increase in this budget line?
Well, it's a couple of things. So there's the gross cost of the hospital, yeah. And then there's the amount that we pay for as the taxpayers within the regional hospital district. You know, it's a lot of money, but it's still a pretty good deal. So the general rule of division of how things are paid for is about 60-40. So when we agree to a new project, a new hospital, if I use easy numbers, if it costs $1 million, mm-hmm. and they cost way more than that, 60% would be borne by the province, 40% by the local taxpayer. So the new hospital in Terrace is worth quite a bit more than that. Mm-hmm. And we, the board, prior to my being there, had negotiated at about a 20% rate with a rate cap. So the actual tax amount to the local taxpayers was a much better rate, mm-hmm. than the normal 60-40. So then when the additional request comes for the special project, it's an additional amount of tax, yes. It's small compared to the gross project, mm-hmm. but yes, there is an additional tax requisition that goes for the neonatal unit.
Mm-hmm. On average, from districts across the Northwest, from Haida Gwaii to Houston, the average taxpayer will pay an additional $6.84 a year until 2049 for the neonatal intensive care unit addition.
Overall, it's still a very good deal. It's going to last for a long time. You know, we think about our private debt. You want to pay things off as quick as possible. You're the payer and you're the beneficiary. You sort that out how it makes sense, mm-hmm. for you. But big public infrastructure is going to last for decades.
But at the end of the day, it's how the board deals with budget issues. Right. So we'll know what that means. If something comes to the board and there's a request made and the board makes a decision, that's when we actually know. So the board does have the authority to set the budget, and budgets can be amended anytime.
Right.
But we're in budget season now. So yeah. We'll see what comes before the board, and the board meets this weekend.
Thank you so much, Gladys.
Well, thanks, Pam.
Wenlita West is a nonprofit which aims to provide practical safety training for women and girls all across BC. Anissa Watson was introduced to Wenlita West when she was learning Taekwondo in Terrace in 2022. She's passionate about working with women and girls and wants to empower and educate them about not only the tactics to use if attacked, but also teaching them to understand the law supporting their claims if they report violence to the police. Women and girls are disproportionately victimized by attacks in their communities, often by someone they know or even an intimate partner. The most recent federal statistics on violence against young women and girls shows a 32% increase from those stats in 2018. While a self-defense class is not the answer to the systemic issue of violence against Indigenous and non-Indigenous women and girls, Anissa felt that she needed to do something to empower young girls to learn to fight.
My name is Anissa Watson. I live in Hazleton, BC here, and I'm a women and girls self-defense instructor with an organization called Wenlita West.
So when I think of self-defense classes, I think of a course I took when I was about 12 years old, teaching me how to escape holds and strike someone bigger than me. Is that what you'll be teaching in this course?
Yeah, that's a component of what we teach. We focus on something called the 5 A's. So we teach people how to access their strengths and abilities and be aware of the sort of the who, what, and why of attacks. So having a little bit more awareness around what types of attacks happen and the types of situations and the power imbalance that's usually at play. And then we teach women and girls about avoiding attacks in general, how to keep themselves safe and their environment safe, and then how to use their voice and assertiveness. And then finally, we teach that action piece around simple, effective techniques for keeping themselves safe. And we try to make it as accessible as possible. All of the techniques that we teach are techniques that have been used in real life situations with success.
And who's your intended audience to participate in the course?
Our course will be for youth age 13 and all the way up to adults. So just starting at around that 13, 14 year mark, and then can teach all the way up to elders.
When you're offering a course like this, you know, obviously it's doing a part to address violence toward women and younger people, and a lot of people on the LGBTQ spectrum as well, just mm-hmm. have a higher rate of more violence toward them. So what's something that you feel is important to teach that may seem a little bit scary, especially when you're seeing some of those 13 and 14 year olds?
Yeah. So one of the things that I've learned over the course of teaching is that especially youth are very much aware of the safety risk of being especially a young female or a young Indigenous female in our communities here. And so the rate of violence against women and girls is extremely high in Canada, and it's been going up. And then Indigenous women and girls experience a higher rate based upon like stats on, you know, based upon like compared to white or non-Indigenous females. We also teach about the law and how to protect ourselves within the confines of Canadian law and what that looks like and what that means. The goal is that the more and more women who are able to use self-defense and access self-defense techniques, the more that we have power in these sort of circumstances where we feel often very powerless. And then we also acknowledge that many women and girls and a lot of the people that take the classes have been in experiences where they've not been able to use self-defense to protect themselves. And so we take that approach of now we're here, we've survived, we're all here alive, and we get to take the next step to learn how to protect ourselves better into the future.
What's the reaction that you typically see from participants in this course?
Generally, people feel incredibly empowered and more confident in themselves by the end of the course. But generally, participants come away from the course having a knowledge of what their rights are, a knowledge of how to act in a self-defense situation, a knowledge of how violence and assault can impact the human brain and the human body, and so why we react in certain ways, and a little bit more safety and respect around the ways that people have responded to violence in the past. And then there's a healing component of coming together again in community and doing this work together. Oftentimes, women feel more connected and safer and understood.
Research shows that women disproportionately experience the most severe forms of intimate partner violence, such as being choked, assaulted, or threatened with a weapon, or being sexually assaulted. And that comes from the Canadian Centre for Justice and Community Safety Statistics.
I really have a passion for teaching self-defense. I feel like it has had such a positive impact on myself in the process of learning it and then being able to teach it in community and then witnessing how women and especially young girls are impacted through the training. It's a real honor to be able to do that in our communities. So, and I just know, like, for myself, I remember the first time I took like a sort of a self-defense type course. This was a really long time ago that I walked out of that course a changed person, because suddenly I felt like I had agency in my own personal safety, which inherently hadn't been there before.
That was my discussion with Anissa Watson, who's teaching a free self-defense course in Terrace this weekend on Saturday, February 1st from 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. at the Caledonia Secondary School Gym in Terrace. It's open to women and girls ages 13 and over, and anyone interested in attending should register on the Tears to Hope website, tears2hopesociety.com, and you will see the poster for this event on the main page.
My name is Carolyn Knox, and I'm the Senior Director of Access to Care for the Canadian Cancer Society.
The Cancer Society has received funding to help people diagnosed with cancer with some of the more, I call these like auxiliary expenses that come with their diagnosis. Can you tell me what those are?
Certainly. Yes, we did receive some generous funding from the government UC that we administer for them. We provide financial assistance, which is travel grants for travel expenses related to cancer care for those who need to travel outside of their own communities. We also provide accommodations. We have lodges in Prince George, Kelowna, Vancouver, and Victoria, where cancer patients can stay for free, and they also receive meals. And we also have ground transportation in communities around the province, where we have volunteer drivers that drive patients to their treatment or diagnostic appointments.
Is this for anyone in BC, or do you need to like pre-apply? If someone is listening to this and they know somebody that this would be a really great service to, how would they go about doing that?
It's actually pretty simple. We have a 1-888-939-3333. Someone will pick up the phone and provide you with information and connect you with any or all of those programs that you can use. We have the Travel Treatment Fund, which is our travel grant program. There's an application form. The amount you receive is based on the distance you're traveling and your income level, but we provide support for people who have a household income over $100,000. So don't think that you will not receive some kind of travel support. And our accommodations as well, same phone number, and you get directed directly to one of our lodges where they can book you and in and tell you all of the details of our accommodations.
Okay. Is it the amount of kilometers traveled, or is that taken into account that there would be people who would be applying for this that are flying from, let's say, Masset on Haida Gwaii?
Well, actually, we do have a partner in Hope Air who does air travel as well. So you can apply with Hope Air. Again, you can still call our same phone number, go to cancer.ca or call 1-888-939-3333, and we can connect you with Hope Air, who does provide free flights. Or we can set you up if you are on the mainland and want to drive to your appointments with our travel grant program. We can help you find accommodation. And then, of course, when you're in, depending on the community you're in, we may have Wheels of Hope program as well. We're currently recruiting drivers in Dawson Creek, Prince Rupert, and Terrace for our Wheels of Hope program.
Is there a limit where this program just, where you can't sort of tap into this assistance anymore?
Well, the travel grant program is currently an annual grant. We are looking at changing that, but for now it's once a year that they get that money. But the accommodations are available at any time. So anytime, if you need to travel once a week, if you need to travel once a month, or once every 6 months, our accommodations are always available to you.
Fire crews from all over the country have been deployed to assist California's fire department, including crews from both the Nedina and the Northwest fire centers here in the north. Spoke with BC Wildfire Service about what BC fire crews will learn while fighting a fire without water.
My name is Erica Berg, and I'm a provincial fire information officer with the BC Wildfire Service. So earlier in January, we deployed around 13 overhead staff to Los Angeles to support Cal Fire in managing, in particular, the Palisades Fire. These staff that were deployed specialized in a variety of management and incident command roles, and they were fully integrated into Cal Fire's incident management team to provide operational support during this significant wildfire event. We have this ongoing relationship with Cal Fire that's been developing over the past 3 years. And so we also have been there to gather some valuable knowledge, enhancing our own operations and processes back in British Columbia. To those overhead staff, we did deploy about 20 Type 1 wildland firefighters along with an agency representative. They arrived on the 16th of January, and they've been working alongside the U.S. Forest Service, Los Angeles County Fire Department, Cal Fire, as well as some other Canadian resources that were deployed. They've been working alongside other hotshot crews to build some familiarity, confidence, conducting some response scenarios and learning everything from being dispatched to mapping, building line with a variety of hand tools, and also fire suppression technique without the availability of water, which is fairly unique.
What has the representation been from the Northwest fire crews?
I believe that from what the Northwest Fire Center did provide, they mentioned something along the lines of four personnel from the center going down. And what I can say is that when the request did go out and we were looking for availability and willingness, that came from, you know, all over the province. And in regards to the firefighters that went down, a lot of those folks are crew supervisors. So still wildland firefighters, just with more experience. And this shift from BC Wildfire shift to more of a 365 approach to being, you know, increasing our staff throughout the year, it does enable us to have kind of that arsenal of staff available for all types of hazards, whether it's, you know, floods, landslides, but even in this case, being able to be available to be deployed as wildland firefighters in what we would typically consider the shoulder season. So having those staff available and willing is great to have that.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me.
Yeah, you're welcome.
That was Erica Berg from the BC Wildfire Service speaking about the Northern fire crews that have gone to California to aid in their fire.
You've been listening to CICK News. If you have any hot tips or news stories you think we should cover, contact us at CICKnews@smithersradio.com or follow us on Facebook at CICK News. CICK News is made possible by the Government of Canada and the Community Radio Fund of Canada, the only organization mandated to financially supporting campus and community radio stations across Canada. You can also catch our fresh shows each week at theskeena.com or subscribe to our podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, wherever you find your podcasts. Thanks to our producer Pam Hassan and all of our roving reporters, I'm Dan Messick. Thanks for listening.